It is impossible to say at this point whether the new administration is going to get us back on track for negotiation in the region. For 60 years, they've been trying to make peace, or just trying to prevent the recurrent wars that have racked the region. The record of success is truly thin.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum, the chair of the forum. Sports writers use the term well-traveled, usually to describe a second-tier player, one who has played supporting roles on many teams in many cities. And in that context, it can be a term of derision. But not so when describing a journalist who has covered international matters for two of America's leading newspapers, the Washington Post for 12 years and the New York Times for 14 years. Our guest, Patrick Tyler, has been a Middle East bureau chief based in Cairo, a Beijing bureau chief, a Moscow bureau chief, and a London bureau chief. He has been indeed well traveled. Patrick Tyler has now dropped anchor in Washington and is writing books about American diplomacy and international diplomacy. Back in 1986, he wrote a book about Admiral Rickover's development of the nuclear navy. And in 2000, he wrote the award-winning A Great Wall, Six Presidents in China. Most recently, he has published A World of Trouble, The White House and the Middle East from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Please welcome Pat Tyler.
George, thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. I am delighted to be here at the Miller Center. This is my first time, and I want to give special thanks to Bill Quandt, who called me out of the blue a while back and said, "I'm reading your book," which was delightful news to me. It's quite intimidating to have Bill and Helena in the front row here tonight, because about two-thirds of the important books on the Middle East have been written by people in the front row. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much of one. This is a wonderful forum. We were talking before we came in about the debate forum that was streamed live on the internet last week on the question of Iran and the nuclear issue. So the Miller Center is at the core of creating fora that are extremely useful to people interested in following our country's foreign policy and its evolution. We arrive here tonight on the cusp of a new era in the Middle East. The only problem is no one knows yet what to call it. Yet there is a feeling that we are in somehow balanced in a very perilous time, with both amazing and hopeful prospects out in the future, but also serious real threats. We're just a few months beyond a disastrous campaign in Gaza that has caused an enormous amount of damage, incited a great new debate about its efficacy, its justification, et cetera, and again reminding us that without a settlement in the Holy Land, the recurrent cycles of violence are likely to continue. It is impossible to say at this point whether the new administration is going to get us back on track for negotiation in the region. There are certainly any number of positive signs. We have seen the interview with Al Arabiya the president gave just days after he was in office, his statements to the Muslim world as recently today, his speech in Turkey, the first such set of systematic comments on his intention to get active on the Middle East front. Expectations could not be higher. And so I come here tonight because I have written a history which is an attempt to present an American reader, a Western reader, with a notion of how each American president since Eisenhower has tried to get his arms around a very difficult region. It's a narrative that documents the fact that our leaders, especially the man in the Oval Office, have not had an easy time from the beginning. For 60 years, they've been trying to make peace or just trying to prevent the recurrent wars that have racked the region. The record of success is truly thin. And one reason is self-evident. Each president has sought to distinguish himself from his predecessor, which is a very human characteristic. But the real reason is more subtle and much larger, and that is that in American foreign policy, the Middle East hasn't had that overarching imperative of national security, similar to what drove us during the Cold War. The intensity of that threat of mutual nuclear annihilation focused American leaders on the basic fundamentals, first and foremost, diplomatic engagement with the enemy, and the profound nurturing and building of transatlantic alliances that would organize the West against this overarching threat. In the Middle East, we have interests. We had interests. I mean, it was a backwater after World War II. The country was mostly focused inward, and to the extent it was focused on anything else, it was the threat of World War III with the Soviet Union. We had interests in the Middle East. We had interests in oil. We had interests in keeping the lines of communication open through the Suez Canal. We had interests in managing the emergence of Israel in a manner that wouldn't destabilize the region or American relationships, important relationships with the Arab world. Interest in controlling the arms race, any arms race, especially the spread, especially the spread of nuclear weapons. And interest in fostering development and prosperity. Not for any sentimental reason, but because prosperity might tame the fires of grievance that were real and intense in the wake of World War II, and were fueled by that post-colonial anger that was rampant and loose in the region. When President Eisenhower looked out across the landscape of the Middle East, I think it's safe to say that his political instincts told him that East and West, the superpowers, would be competing for the hearts and minds of millions of Arabs and Muslims, but also Christians and others that were the diverse population of the region. Now we are one superpower, and the struggle remains for the hearts and minds in the region. But the competition has changed, and I usually use in my own mind, the shorthand to describe it because it is an endless subject this way, to say it's us against the fringe. President Eisenhower looked out and thought that he, as a wartime commander, could apply the same big thoughts to looking for reconciliation strategies in the region. And here is the man who devised the interstate highway system, embraced the Tennessee Valley Authority. He wanted to take those kind of ideas into the Middle East to try and find a solution. After all, he came into office just a few years after the War of Independence had created Israel. There had been a civil conflict. The Arab states had attacked, and they had settled along armistice lines that defined Israel with that narrow waist and the long wedge of the Negev desert, as it was in the first decade. And he thought that by bringing hydroelectric power into the Jordan Valley, that you could turn the barren hills of that valley in the West Bank into an agricultural mecca, and that might coax the 700,000-odd Palestinian refugees out of their squalid camps, their tents, their hovels in that landscape across the Levant, and onto farms where peace would break out, the president thought, the core of the conflict, which was the refugee problem, would be settled. Of course, neither side was ready for it in the mid-1950s. The Israelis were focused on garnering the resources, the water resources of the upper Jordan Valley, to pipe it down to the Negev. They weren't quite ready to share. The Palestinians weren't really organized to engage them in any formal way, and the United States was basically dealing with the Arab leaders in the region who were speaking for the Palestinians. And it went nowhere, but Eisenhower truly tried on a grand scale over a number of years, up until really the Suez Crisis, to come up with artful and creative and big ideas that might solve the festering core of the Arab-Israeli dispute. John F. Kennedy learned during his transition from the time of his election to the time he was sworn in January 1961, that the Israel was building a secret nuclear complex in the Negev Desert that would be capable to produce atomic weapons. President Kennedy wondered, especially after the Cuban Missile Crisis, how he could work to enforce a non-proliferation regime, how he could get control of nuclear weapons in the region, or prevent the spread of nuclear weapons in the region. And if he couldn't, if he was in any way to convince nations like China and India to forgo those steps into the nuclear sphere, how could he prevent them if he couldn't prevent tiny Israel? Amos Elon, who was the great Haaretz journalist, told me once that he and Scotty Reston were walking down a hallway in the West Wing of the White House, and they ran into JFK. Those were the days when journalists could wander rather freely in the White House. And he was seething about the latest reports that Ben-Gurion was working on this Dimona reactor that was going to give Israel nuclear weapons. And he was determined to stop it. And he reiterated the intensity of his determination to these two journalists. Amos Elon says that he went out and typed up a story about JFK's anger and submitted it to the censor in Israel, and it was spiked and of course never saw the light of day in the Israeli press. And Scotty Reston, as far as we know, never wrote about it, although the Times covered the issue during the 60s. Scotty did not record this moment of presidential anger. In any case, JFK was still working on turning Ben-Gurion around when he was killed in Dallas. And by the time Lyndon Johnson came into office, he continued to press on the nuclear front. But since China went ahead and got its nuclear capability when it tested its first weapon in 1964, and India was then on the road to getting its capability, he didn't see it in the same terms as JFK had. And by the time Richard Nixon came into office, he was no longer interested in preventing an Israeli nuclear deterrent, because if you remember Nixon, through the Nixon Doctrine that we remember mostly because of its application to Vietnam, authored the concept that we would arm our allies and keep and bring our troops home. And so he was looking for strong allies who were armed and equipped pursue congruent policies in the world with the United States, Israel, Iran under the Shah, and eventually Saudi Arabia also. In the summer of 1973, if you could spin forward a little bit, Leonid Brezhnev literally got Richard Nixon out of bed at San Clemente during their summit in June of 1973 to tell him that war was coming in the Middle East. And Brezhnev was genuinely concerned. I think that if we have some Soviet scholars here, it is possible to say that with detente, the policy of Nixon's policy of detente under some pressure during his second term, that Brezhnev was under the same pressure to show some of the benefits of detente. In other words, he wanted to collaborate with Nixon to prevent wars, to undertake security strategies in the world that would be enforced or reinforced by superpower cooperation. Brezhnev knew that war was coming in the Middle East because the Soviet military was arming the Arabs. And the Arabs had a definite program to take back the land they had lost in the Six-Day War. Remember when the Israelis took the Sinai from them, the Golan Heights, and the West Bank. But Brezhnev was there to say that he and Nixon, if they basically established a few basic principles, importantly among them the security concerns of Israel, that they could begin a dialogue, a negotiation that Kissinger and Anatoly Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador, could manage and could be supervised by the two superpower leaders, and that they could head off a war in the Middle East and make some progress on the peace agenda. Yet at that time, if you remember, the summer of 73 was the summer of the Watergate hearings. Sam Ervin was running that running that program on television that summer. It had the country captivated, and Nixon was politically paralyzed by the Watergate scandal. He was terrified that a high-profile diplomatic initiative in the Middle East might set off a neuralgic reaction in the Senate. And the Senate was going to be the place that decided his fate if the Watergate investigation turned into an impeachment. And so he demurred. He rebuffed Brezhnev's very tenacious attempt to draw him in to a collaboration. And we know this because the memorandum of conversation has been declassified about this late night meeting. And it's a fascinating insight into the attempt by the Soviet leader to put flesh and bones on detente that summer and to head off a war that Moscow had determined was just simply not in the Soviet in the Soviet Union's interest. After all, they had the Arabs had lost in 67, and it had cost Moscow an enormous amount of capital to rearm the Arabs, and the prospect of a second war I think was genuinely sobering to the Soviet leader. But war, what happened? War did break out 4 months later. Brezhnev had been right. It was one of the most costly wars in Israel's history. I think if the average Israeli knew at that time how much the two superpower heads of state had the fate, had their fate in their hands the summer before, that the recriminations would have been significant. As it was, recriminations washed over Israeli society deeply after the 73 war because it was caught by surprise, and Golda Meir lost her job because of it. The chief of staff, Dado Eliezer, lost his job over it. Moshe Dayan essentially lost his job over it. And it was one of the most catastrophic moments in the history of Middle East warfare. I'll just touch on a couple of other presidents. I'd like to explain the dilemma that Ronald Reagan faced when Menachem Begin surprised him with the war in Lebanon in June of 1982. Ronald Reagan came into office wanting very much to do what Jimmy Carter had done, to make some real contribution to the peace process. Carter had brought home the Camp David Accords. It was the pinnacle of his presidency, but also of the record of the history of Middle East peacemaking. And Reagan was very much attracted to that notion. But that's not what Menachem Begin was all about in Lebanon. He was going in there to destroy the PLO, to kill Yasser Arafat if he could, to humiliate the Syrian army, and to build an alliance, perhaps, with the Maronite Christian leadership of Lebanon that would be a Jewish-Christian alliance and a new a paradigm of power in the Middle East. And Ronald Reagan, as he brought his cabinet in before him to debate and discuss what he should do about the war in Lebanon, couldn't decide how to define it. On the one hand, he had people like Jean Kirkpatrick, who was the ambassador to the United Nations, and William Casey, who was the CIA director, arguing that this is the work, we're doing God's work here, supporting the Israelis, because they're going in and destroying a Soviet-backed PLO cabal under Yasser Arafat, who is a Soviet-backed agent, and the Soviet-backed Syrian military, which threatens the existence of Israel. On the other hand, you had his some of the Arabists in his administration saying that this is a disastrous a campaign by an Israeli military and leadership that has overreached, that is destroying the fabric of society in Lebanon, that is going to turn that population in, against the United States, and that we'll be picking up the pieces of this for decades. And Reagan would literally say it on one hand, you know, I agree with Gene, and then I agree with Schultz. And he couldn't simply make up his mind. And his biographer used the phrase cruel innocence about his approach to these questions, where he, especially where he couldn't decide what his policy would be. And as a result, we spent two full years ricocheting around the landscape of the burning and bleeding landscape of Lebanon until we got out, at the cost of, if you'll recall, the terrible cost of our Marines when 240 of them were killed, and our U.S. Embassy and many of its personnel when it was blown up in April of 1983. President Nixon understood paralysis and gridlock, and that's where we remain to some extent in the Middle East today. And history shows us that there is no simple formula for breaking it. And I think, however, there are a couple of observations that one could make that would be useful into how to the formulation of policy that is being undertaken today in the Obama administration. One of them is that I think we have lost the ability to some extent to believe in or have confidence in the multinational role. Our faith in the institutions that we largely shaped to resolve conflicts after World War II has eroded. And yet joint action under NATO, under the UN peacekeeping mandate, even unilateral deployments with international backing of some sort, have great potential when commanded and directed and supervised by seasoned and determined leaders. And President Obama likes to talk about responsibility. I think it's fair to say that if we don't take our responsibility to shape the peace in the Holy Land, we leave Israel in the impossible position of defending borders that are not fully under anyone's control, except the hooded guys with rockets. One other observation, I think, is American leaders have lost confidence to some extent in taking the initiative at a time when Israel has preempted the field with military operations. There is no political advisor on earth, I think, that you could find who will go in a modern White House today and tell a president that he has options to stop the Israelis when they are in the field. And the Israelis, the Israeli leadership from time to time factors our, and calculates our reaction significantly in their determination of whether they can move and whether they will succeed. And there's nothing like leadership expressed by a strong and determined White House to have an impact on those calculations and that decision making. And I think our leaders need to resurrect that determination. It won't be easy for a new president. But the positive reality is that the expectations, which continue to soar, as we saw today and yesterday with the crowds that he addressed in Prague and his speech today in Turkey, are creating their own imperative for American diplomatic activism. And you can never underestimate the power of presidential activism, especially when it's backed by international support. So we hope for the best while we prepare for the worst. And I always like to quote Yitzhak Rabin at the where I would like to stop and take questions by announcing that I am the last speaker. Now, who has questions?
Let me prime the pump with the first sure. question. Thank you very much for covering as much of the landscape as you did in your opening comments. There are serious observers of the Middle East who think that the United States has run aground by being too much under the influence of Israel and Israel's friends in the United States. Do you think that Obama will steer foreign policy in a different direction and be less influenced by the interests of Israel?
Well, this is kind of the Mersheimer and Walt question, as I like to call it. It's the question of the power and the place of the pro-Israel lobby in the Congress and the various organizations, AIPAC, and others that make up the meat and bones of what is essentially a very diverse group of organizations and interests. I think President Obama, because he spent some time in the Senate, has had the education on the constituencies in the United States that react and focus on the Middle East and the formulation of Middle East policy. I think that the strength of those constituencies is an ever-changing landscape. I think if anyone has noticed that AIPAC has been counterbalanced in the last year by the formation of a new lobbying group that positions itself more to the center and to the center left of the political spectrum. It's called the J Street Lobby in Washington. And its notion, I think its formation, was caused or essentially by the sentiment that AIPAC had become an institution that was much more responsive to the Israeli right, the right wing of Israeli politics, and that it wasn't in the interest of American leaders to have that to be the loudest voice in the lobbying scrum that occurs whenever legislation is moving through Congress or a new policy is being formulated. So I think it is undeniable that any new president is going to become a student of the constituencies that speak to the Middle East issue. Is Obama different in his responsiveness? No, he's got Hillary Clinton in the State Department. She was the senator from New York. No one speaks as eloquently for the lobby as does the senator from New York on most occasions. And so I think there's a great sensitivity there. But underneath it, underlying it, I think is a great determination to be both effective and successful in the Middle East. And I think Obama sees his destiny in part as an American leader in terms of having arrived at a critical moment where the window may be closing, but it is still open, where there is a consensus in the world for a two-state solution in the Holy Land, and where it's still possible through hard work and luck to make that happen. And I think he really rises to that particular task.
In a recent New York Times op-ed, Roger Cohen congratulates a British decision to recognize Hezbollah as a political actor in Lebanon, and he encourages the United States to do the same. I'd be curious to see your comments on this decision.
Yeah, I was sitting with a former head of the Mossad in a cafe in Israel last month. I was there doing interviews for a new book I'm working on the Israeli security establishment. And I can name this fellow. It wasn't a secret conversation. It was Ephraim Halevi, who was the head of the Mossad under Bibi Netanyahu and then under Sharon. He was also Sharon's national security advisor. But he was really a Rabin person who helped in the secret diplomacy with King Hussein in 1994 when that peace treaty was formulated. But he said to me, when I asked him the question about should the administration be talking to Hamas, should Israel be talking to Hamas, he says, what have you got today? Who is in Cairo speaking to Omar Suleiman, who is the chief of Egyptian intelligence? You've got Israeli negotiators, you've got Amos Gilad, and you've got Hamas. Like it or not, we are talking to Hamas every day. I mean, it is the fig leaf of being in separate rooms, but we have essentially been negotiating with them on how to rearrange the Philadelphia Quarter, how to close the tunnels, how to receive more aid and manage the distribution of that aid, and how to find some reconciliation in the Palestinian community so that Hamas and Fatah can put their differences aside and find some modus vivendi. So that negotiations can continue. So I think that the political test of trying to draw a red line that you cannot talk to Hamas, it's a terrorist organization, will crumble as fast as it did a couple of decades ago when the same question was asked about whether we can talk to the PLO. Hamas is there to stay. It's a real factor in Gaza. Both Israel and the other Arab states and the United States are going to have to communicate with it to come to terms on how to settle the differences in the Palestinian community.
Do you feel that it's possible to have a two-state solution without the elimination of those settlements on the West Bank? And do you think Israel will ever have the political wherewithal to move on something like that?
It's interesting. I had someone make the statement to pose the question to me a few weeks ago of whether there had ever been a conflict where, in the resolution of it, you were able to move 400,000 or 500,000 people out of a territory they had occupied to somewhere else. And I said, I can't think of anything in history. And then someone across the table said Algeria. So there was a repatriation. There is a precedent for it. There's a kind of a budding debate out there about whether the window is closed and whether it's simply too late to have a two-state solution. And I say to the people who peddle that notion that it's the kind of notion that grows when there's a vacuum of presidential intervention with a plan. And we haven't seen what the plan is from this administration, but I think we're going to. And I don't think anyone will be arguing that the window is closed in a few months when we know what that plan is and how they're going to work it. You can be rattled about this issue. When I was in Israel this time, I was up in the West Bank, and a European diplomat was showing me the map that the Palestinian Authority was distributing to the diplomatic community, showing an area called E1, which is another area of empty land that the settlement movement wants to put 75,000 houses into over the next 10 years. If you put that many houses in E1 in the West Bank, you then get a population of settlers that is so large that you could argue that you've passed the point of no return on being able to create a viable Palestinian state. So the short answer to the question is I think it is still the active option, and it happens to be the one that the President of the United States is focused on. He believes in a two-state solution. I think we're going to see what he puts down on paper in the near term, even though it may not go as fast as some people want it to. I think we're going to see the broad outlines of it fairly soon.
Patrick, I was kind of surprised to hear you say that you think that there is no possibility that an American president would rein in an Israeli military operation anywhere. But I find that hard to believe. I think maybe it's more a function of us maybe having gotten used to the Bush administration and, you know, the fact that Condi Rice and Bush thought that the Israeli attacks against Lebanon was a birth pangs of the new democracy, and then they gave them essentially a carte blanche in Gaza. But the big thing that people are talking about now is the prospect of an Israeli military attack on Iran. And we have 130,000 soldiers right next to Iran at the end of very long and vulnerable supply lines. So is it honestly the case that an American president would just allow Israel to draw what would almost certainly be Iranian retaliation against our own forces right there in the region, not least because there's no way the Israeli attack planes or drones or missiles or whatever could get to Iran without passing through our controlled, U.S.-controlled airspace.
It's a very good point, especially about Iran. I'd like to extend and amend my remarks only to the extent that I thought what I said was that you would find no political advisor in a White House today who would advise a president to intervene once an Israeli military operation was underway. Here's the point about Iran. It is true that in the military you call these deconfliction rules. It is true that the Israelis cannot pass through the airspace over Iraq and attack Iran without having our permission, because we control that airspace. The IFF codes, the identification friend or foe on all those planes have to be coordinated or they'll get shot down. That's the threat of that happening. What I mean by that, Helena, is that if this new Israeli government under Benjamin Netanyahu, by its earliest words on this issue, is going to try and do what President Clinton always used to use the word, they're trying to jam me. And I think Bibi Netanyahu is going to try and jam the new president a little bit toward a congruent attitude on setting a red line on Iran, and if it's not met, if we can't stop the nuclear program diplomatically, that we will somehow join or condone a military action to destroy the Iranian nuclear complex. I don't know how the Obama administration is going to handle this very, very tough issue. I don't think President Obama wants a war in the world with the worldwide economic crisis still in full flower. I'm not sure he thinks that the United States is in a position to or is wise to try and prevent Iran from crossing the nuclear threshold. I think wherever he holds that deep belief, it's well shrouded. What I mean is that if the Israelis convince themselves that they have to do it themselves and are willing to do it themselves, that once they undertake it, and maybe they won't undertake it by aircraft. When I was in Israel, they were talking about using Jericho missiles to fly over the envelope and use 40 or so missiles to take out the main complex of Iranian nuclear facilities. If they undertake it, I don't see this president, and I think it would be extremely difficult for any American president to take them on once they are in the field. And that's because they are a regional superpower, and they have the wherewithal, both in the air, naval, and ground capabilities, intelligence capabilities, satellite communications and reconnaissance capabilities, to go a long way without concern about the United States either undermining them or preventing them from reaching their goals. It's a very, very tough question. I think it's the hardest thing today for an American president to consider with regard to military operations in the Middle East, is how to react when Israel goes into the field, how to stop it.
It seems like the issue of Jerusalem is one of the more difficult hurdles to get, sticking points to get past the two-state solution. Can you talk about what are some of the more viable solutions that are being discussed right now with regards to Jerusalem?
It's the most difficult problem in the world, probably, and I'm not an expert on it. I am fully versed on what has been put on the table in the various negotiations, and I think the way you would describe that is, in essence, there has been an attempt to find a way to share sovereignty of the Temple Mount, of that 30-something acre mesa that sits in the middle of the and dominates the old city of Jerusalem. And the problem with that is that there's no such thing as shared sovereignty. And that you've got the most virulent and intense and emotional nationalistic feelings tied up in both communities toward the sacred status of that piece of real estate. I thought that they had come to some very clever ideas when President Clinton put the parameters down on the table in December 2000 essentially giving the Temple Mount sovereignty to the Palestinians, and then kind of weasel-worded how the sovereignty of the Wailing Wall would and what it was connected to would go to the Jews. And the problem was that neither side had prepared its constituencies and its public very well for that the broaching of these ideas. And the debate has only gotten more intense in the intervening years. It's going to take an enormous amount of creativity. I think the basic issue, some of the basic issues have broad agreement, and that is what is Jewish should be part of the Jewish capital and what is Arab should be part of the Arab capital. Of course, there are all of these controversies about knocking down houses and the creeping movement of both populations within the city that are very emotional and are underway at this moment in East Jerusalem. I think the construct is going to be something that's going to have to be blessed by religious authorities and not just the local ones. And that's going to take some outside diplomacy. So I think that is something both for the United States and also the Arab and Muslim leadership to deal with in engaging the rabbinical authorities in Israel. And I don't think we've gotten to the most interesting part of that particular debate and discussion and division of the celestial assets of the two nations.
Your mentioning of political advisors brings to mind a recent event regarding the selection of political advisors. I was wondering what your thoughts were on Chaz Freeman and whether or not he was a poor choice originally for head of the National Intelligence Council, whether it was a mistake to withdraw his selection, and what the long-term consequences might be of that event.
Well, I think I'd have to argue a little bit with your description of the chairman of the National Intelligence Council being a political job. It's not really a political job. It is a job for the analyst in chief of the intelligence community to sit there and try and reconcile all of the competing analysis so that when they present the President of the United States their ideas about what's going on in the Middle East or China or Russia, that they do so with a fairly stated consensus view that also says something that will be useful to the President. Chaz Freeman, I've known him for quite a long time. I knew him because he's a China specialist, and I spent a good bit of time in China. And I got him in trouble once when he was carrying on a very interesting dialogue with one of their senior officers in the People's Liberation Army, who said to Chaz one day that, you know, the Americans don't want to make a mistake here because otherwise they'll see Los Angeles disappear or something like that. And he took it as a unvarnished kind of nuclear threat. And I was one of the first, I'm not sure how many people he called, but I was one of the people he called, and he was shocked that this had been said. And of course, I put it in the New York Times the next day, at which point I think the general called him and raised holy hell that his comment had been bounced around the world the way it had in the New York Times. Chaz and I have had differences about the provenance of that statement and whether how much permission I had to put it in the paper at the time. So that's the source of the argument. In any case, he is a very bright, experienced person. I mean, he's a person who speaks Chinese and Arabic, and in each field of study that he's gone into as a diplomat has mastered that field. He's a strong analyst. There are people who would argue whether he was the best person qualified for that job. I think there are people who felt that some of his statements on the Arab-Israeli dispute were too strong, and some of his statements about China were too strong. I think, you know, if you put a microphone in the CIA where the analysts argue, you expect to hear strong statements. I didn't feel that strong statements should disqualify people. None of them showed any kind of innate bias that, in my estimation. My biggest feeling, and I'm not an expert on everything that happened after he was appointed by Dennis Blair, the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, but I thought he gave up a little early. And maybe it's because I don't know that the White House wanted him to give up the day that he threw in the towel. But if you look at people who've been shot at, who while they were being appointed to important posts, he didn't stay too long on the stage taking the arrows before he retired. And maybe it's because that's what Barack Obama wanted. He didn't want a controversy over his chairman of the NIC. So in that case, it's not Chaz's fault. But if you look at, I like to compare it to Dennis Ross's appointment. He's been named the advisor on Iran. A lot of people have been shooting at Dennis because he didn't have very much Iran experience at all. And there are all sorts of complaints expressed about him. But Dennis took all the arrows and defended himself privately and is in the job today and is functioning. You may not agree with everything he's ever done or written or said, but he's a bright guy who's serving the Secretary of State. And if Chaz had the option, I am disappointed that he didn't stay in the fight longer. And by bowing out and blaming it on the Israeli lobby, I thought was a little precipitous and possibly unfair, because I didn't see the evidence that they had marshaled any massive campaign against him. Maybe you know of more evidence. I think a couple people took shots at him, but it didn't seem that that drastic, and I was sorry that he gave up.
So I want to ask you a question about your book. Sure. I had the pleasure of reading it, and I think you have a interpretation of the failure of the peace efforts in the Clinton period that goes contrary to the conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom being that Clinton summoned Ehud Barak of Israel and Yasser Arafat, head of the PLO, to Camp David in the summer of 2000, that Barak made a generous offer, unprecedentedly generous. Arafat turned it down, and the rest is history. Your version is considerably more complex, and I'd like you to spell it out in enough detail to tell us what you think went wrong in those last 6 months or so of the Clinton period, because that really was the last time that a president seriously engaged in Arab-Israeli peacemaking. And a lot of conclusions have been drawn from that failure. Some of them, I think, in light of what you've written, are not accurate conclusions based on the record. So could you just try to reconstruct in a few minutes your picture of what went wrong, and particularly in the end game?
How long have you got? let me just try and hit the high points. First of all, Bill Clinton desperately wanted to make peace at Camp David in the summer of 2000. It was his last year. Monica, impeachment, all of those things. He wanted that legacy badly. He had worked hard. He had mastered the narrative of the Palestinians and the narrative of Israel, and he wanted to make that contribution. He knew the deal was close, and Ehud Barak, the Israeli prime minister, was telling him that he thought it was possible. The problem was no one was ready for Camp David. Ehud Barak's chief of intelligence told him that he no longer had a partner in Yasser Arafat, that he had alienated him by the way he had treated him in the period up until Camp David. The Americans certainly weren't ready. And Ehud Barak, when he got in the airplane, and this is not in my book because I've learned it since, sat there and put a pencil on the table and said, here is our position. If we get peace, everything stands up, and I keep, you know, it's supported. If we don't get a deal, everything collapses. And the meaning was that we will then have to blame Arafat, blame the Palestinians, and try to go for our own political survival. Well, what happened? They didn't get the deal. Arafat had asked President Clinton, listen, I'll come to Camp David, but if we don't get a deal, would you promise not to blame me? And Bill Clinton looked Yasser Arafat in the eye and said, I will not blame you. And of course, what did he do? They didn't get the deal. They came down from Camp David, and Bill Clinton not only blamed Yasser Arafat, he then went on his Israeli TV and blamed him double. And there was a demonization of the Palestinian leadership that occurred over the next 6 months that was all about saving Ehud Barak, because he was Clinton's closest confidant in the peace process. In fact, Clinton had essentially turned over management of the peace process to Ehud Barak, and he called him several times a day and almost told him what to do. I mean, he really thought Barak was a genius, and he knew how to make peace, and that he knew what he was doing. He was wrong. Barak didn't know what he was doing. He made a lot of mistakes. He was a brilliant military commander, but a lousy politician and not a very good diplomatic negotiator. So what happened is the Intifada went off in September, after Ariel Sharon went up on the Temple Mount and threw gasoline onto that issue for the Palestinians. And what happened is something that is extraordinary, is that the military turned against Ehud Barak. The IDF turned against Ehud Barak, because the IDF believed from its internally that Arafat was not going to make peace, that Barak was weak, that Sharon was coming, and that they should harden up, toughen up their analysis. And this put Barak on the fence those last few months from the fall until the end of the Clinton administration, whether to go with his own military, where his leading analysts were saying Arafat is bankrupt, you can't make peace with him, and they were implementing a plan that was destroying the infrastructure of the Palestinian Authority. Or whether to hold out for a last-minute deal that would allow him to save his government, go to a plebiscite, and become a peacemaker with Bill Clinton and win the Nobel Prize. What happened in December was that when Clinton laid down the parameters, Clinton and Barak both allowed themselves to believe that something was still possible. And you had a number of interventions by important characters like Prince Bandar, who was the Saudi envoy in Washington, who, while he was supporting everything Arafat did, was also radiating his own affection and high expectations for an incoming Bush administration. Because Bandar's nickname is Bandar Bush. From the first Gulf War, he was so close to the Bush family, and particularly close to George W. Bush. They had been drinking buddies in the 80s when George Sr. was vice president. And Bandar was radiating this alternative possibility to Arafat, that if you wait, you'll have a Bush in the White House, will be much more sympathetic, you'll get a better deal, even though and Clinton, God bless him, he's laid down a good predicate for that. You've gotten 90% of the deal already, and you'll be able to close it under a new president. And if Sharon wins, and Arafat didn't believe that Sharon could win, he'll discredit himself, or the Americans will control him, because that's what a Bush president was capable of doing. He had been, after all, Bush and Baker had been tough on Yitzhak Shamir in an earlier decade. So people got mixed signals on what was possible and when to make decisions. And I think what happened was Arafat didn't feel the same urgency as the American and the Israeli leaders did. He didn't also understand the consequences that would have for him, and how many people would turn on him when things happened that he hadn't expected to happen. Sharon winning and becoming a successful prime minister and really taking the fight into the Palestinian street, and Clinton disappearing, and George W. Bush becoming a completely different leader than anyone in the Palestinian camp had expected.
You talked a lot about the conflict between the Arabs and the Israelis in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, but can you talk a little bit about the relationship between Israel and Syria and the prospects for a peace deal involving the Golan Heights?
I think a peace deal is ready. When we were talking earlier, Helena said something to me that made me think that, gosh, maybe there are lots of things I don't know about all the complexities there are. But some of the people I've been talking to in Israel have been working on those negotiations and have described the declaration of principles, the package concept of how to make peace, how to return the Golan Heights to Syria, but keep it as an Israeli economic zone. And that deal is the broad outlines of it that are accepted on both sides. I may be corrected when we see the actual plan on paper, but I believe Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian leader, doesn't have some of these attachments that his father had for being with his foot in the Sea of Galilee and insisting on a border regime that was going to be very tough for the Israelis. He keeps insisting on the 67 line, but he is less, how should I say it, fanatical about how to draw it. I think that the Israelis are ready, the Israeli leadership in both parties, in all parties, are virtually ready for this deal. The Syrians have been waiting for a new American leadership, because they want the Americans in the room when they make this deal, because if they are going to pull themselves away to some extent from Iran, and that may be the complex and gradual process, they will need a strong Western anchor to help them accomplish that. And so the promises of American engagement, Western engagement, economic development, all of those things, a new Syrian move back to the West is critical for the success of a deal. The other critical question here is that if you make peace with Syria, what do you do with the Palestinian track, which is now a disheveled mess because the Palestinians aren't unified? And what is I think there's a strong sentiment in the region that these things have to be synchronized in a way that it looks like the tracks are getting equal time and equal intensity from an American president, that the Palestinians aren't ignored. And people are talking about the risk, if you don't do that, of a third intifada, of a spasm of violence breaking out in the region. And that's a real risk. And the Palestinians felt very much slighted the last time by being left as the Clinton administration pursued what they called the other woman, the Syrian track. So the Syrians are ready. The Israelis, I think, are ready. Bibi Netanyahu secretly carried on negotiations with Syria. The deal that he was after in the mid-90s was pretty close to the deal that has shaped up in the private talks over the last 2 years. So it's a very pregnant issue, and we're waiting for it to give birth as soon as there's a moment when everybody is ready. And it's I think we're close to that moment.
I've not yet had the opportunity to read your book, but I'm looking forward to it. My question relates to the whole span of time that you cover, and I'd like you to simply reflect on when was the most, in your opinion, when was the most likely time for a Palestinian-Israeli settlement? Why did it not happen? And what are the specific lessons to be drawn from that particular incident?
Well, it's interesting. I think there's a lot of history underneath that question, because the Palestinians were the focus of the Zionists during the early part of the last century, as they started looking at how they would deal with the indigenous population if they got their state. Would there be a state with the Palestinian Arabs? Would it be separate states? There were a number of discussions with King Abdullah in neighboring Jordan about how to arrange the West Bank, how to divide up the two areas in which the Palestinians might get autonomy under a Jordanian arrangement early on. I guess the first opportunity or the first serious look that the Israelis looked at it was after the Six-Day War, when they swept over the West Bank and took it away from Jordan. And they sent a committee of military men and intelligence officers out to interview all of the local mayors of the Palestinian towns and cities to ask them what they wanted and what kind of arrangement they would support. And there was just days after the close of the Six-Day War, there was a memorandum written in the Israeli military from this committee that I'm not sure got all the way up to the cabinet, which was at that time trying to decide the question. But in any case, because the Israeli leadership at that time had on the cabinet people like Menachem Begin, who believed that the West Bank was the fulfillment of the land of Israel, wasn't about to give it away to anybody, having just seized it, that it wasn't possible to seriously think about Palestinian autonomy then. So it was the first time they engaged it, but it didn't really come close to any kind of realization. Then you had Bill Rogers under President Nixon, his Secretary of State, who came up with the Rogers Plan, which was a Palestinian autonomy plan. Didn't go anywhere because Golda Meir didn't like the idea of it, and Kissinger was secretly telling her through one of his friends that she could criticize it and ignore it if she wanted to. Then you have Camp David, where the Palestinian autonomy element was so important as a fig leaf to so many of the people in the room during those negotiations, but wasn't able to be implemented because it didn't have support in the Arab world. I think by the time one of the historic problems that had to be worked out was recognizing the partner, and it didn't come until the late 1980s that the United States, found the wherewithal to begin a dialogue with the PLO and recognize that this was the leadership that the internal population looked at as their leaders, and that if there was going to be a peace and a state and a two-state solution, you had to start talking to them. And the rest, the increments. So Oslo was the most promising opportunity, but it was flawed in some ways that might have been overcome, we'll never know, but in the most important way by the loss of Yitzhak Rabin, who was one of its conceptualizers and who was assassinated by a right-winger in Israel. And I think then, of course, the last best chance was December of 2000 when Bill Clinton laid down the parameters and Yasser Arafat sat there and thought, well, will I get a better deal now or should I wait? And he decided to wait.
Patrick Tyler's very important book is A World of Trouble, The White House and the Middle East from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Thank you very much, Patrick Tyler.